Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
On Friday, October 24th, the Norris Group proudly presents its 7th annual award-winning black tie event, I Survived Real Estate. An incredible lineup of industry experts will join Bruce Norris to discuss perplexing industry trends, head-scratching legislation, and opportunities emerging for real estate professionals. Proceeds for the event benefit Make-A-Wish and St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. This event could not have been possible without the generous help of the following platinum partners: Auction.com, HousingWire, Property Radar, The Apartment Owners Association, the San Diego Creative Real Estate Investors Association and President Bill Tan, Invest Club for Women and Iris Veneration, San Jose Real Estate Investors Association and Geraldine Berry, MVT Productions, and White House Catering. For event information, visit isurvivedrealestate.com.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris. Our special guest today is Bill Cosgrove. He is the chairman-elect of the Mortgage Bankers Association. Bill began his career in the mortgage banking industry in 1986 as a loan officer and has served in many positions for the Mortgage Bankers Association, including the president of the Ohio MBA from 2007 to 2008. And on October 19th, Bill will officially be sworn in as the chairman of the Mortgage Bankers Association. And we welcome you to our show, Bill.
Well, thank you, Bruce. I'm happy to be here.
You said you just got back into town, and so does that mean you were at a meeting in Washington or another state?
We were late last week. We were in D.C. and meeting with the administration and other folks from HUD and Treasury and so forth, and then just got back from the Mortgage Banking Convention of the Carolinas in Charleston, South Carolina. So, and just got back today. So it's been good, but busy.
You in just another week, you have your regulatory compliance get together from September 28th to the 30th. How is your industry coping with the changes? And are most of the changes now a known commodity, and we're ready to get on with business as usual?
Well, you know, I think, Bruce, the new norm, so to speak, is with us. And after QM came out this past January, it's settled down a little bit. But the 800-pound gorilla, and I think the next shoe to drop, is for the residential side, the new Respatilia documents that are going to come out in August of 15. And everybody's geared up for really new good faith estimates and new truth in lending. So that will be that'll create some shock waves in the industry. But that's what we're working on next. And we're also working with the regulators in Washington to try to streamline things and get the regulations right, so we can get the housing markets back on track.
The regulations are, when they're implemented, let's say in August 2015, will that make the process simpler for the mortgage industry and more understandable for the borrowing client?
Unfortunately, it probably won't. The Respatilia documents that are coming out, it was mandated with Dodd-Frank in 2010, and it's sort of the last piece of the puzzle, the last major piece that's put in from Dodd-Frank. Unfortunately, the documents, we don't believe at MBA, are going to be an improvement and probably complicated a little more. So at MBA, we really want to work with the CFPB to do everything we can to streamline them. But I don't think it's going to be an improvement in the current system, but we've got to work with CFPB to improve what's possibly going to be a difficult process.
So you constantly meet about things that still could be implemented or changed in the Respatilia document. Is that correct?
Yeah, we do. And you know, there's a lot of good we've done with CFPB. With QM, they listened to us a lot, and we had a lot of constructive dialogue around points and fees and in creating safe harbor, you know, if the loan was under 43%. So we've done a lot of good work with the CFPB in a lot of different areas. But when it comes to Respitalia, I think there's still a lot of work to be done between now and August of 15. But again, this piece was mandated by Dodd-Frank, and the CFPB is really just acting upon the final pieces of that law, Bruce, and that's what we're dealing with there.
The CFPB, how long has that been established, and is it fully functional at this point?
It was established as part of part of Dodd-Frank around 2010, so it's about 3.5 years old. I think they've ramped up from ground zero, so to speak, to about 1,600 employees, and obviously it now has gone into payday lending, and you know, you've seen headlines of auto loans, and so it's sort of like a spider web where it's really branching out even beyond real estate. Hopefully, you know, when it comes to the mortgage space, there's a lot of work that has already been done, and after Respitalia, you know, hopefully not much else left to do in our space.
You've been in this industry almost 28 years. I would imagine the last 6 years probably have seen more changes than you ever imagined you'd see. Are we at this point being able to loan to creditworthy people, or are they by and large, let's say people that used to get yes answers that were on the margin, are they still not participating in being able to buy a property?
Yeah, that's a great question, Bruce. You know, we at MBA, we have very clear statistical data that it's been a recovery at the top. And with all the regulation that's in place and the credit buckets are very tight, what we've seen is the middle class and the low end of the market, and especially the first-time home buyer, has really suffered with the increased regulation and decreased credit bucket. Nationally, the first-time home buyer, which is extremely important, if not the most important part of the whole ecosystem, so to speak, the ecosystem of purchasing a home in the real estate market, nationally over the last 30 years has been 40% of the market. And today, that number is between 28% and 32%. So there has been a good recovery at the top of the market, but the bottom of the market is still suffering. And we believe it's the regulation that has made the lenders very conservative with those credit buckets. So because of the risk of buybacks, because of the risk of the repurchases, because of the legal risk, we believe there are some of the borrowers that are qualified are not getting loans, that if they're on the fringes, it's easier for a lender to say no than face the possible consequences of doing that loan.
And I think what you're saying is that even though they feel like, by and large, those people would make the payment, that there would be a chance that they would have to buy back the loan at some point?
That's correct. If they're very close on qualifying ratios, if they're very close on credit scores, and other things like that, today, the scrutiny where if you're a lender today, I use the term that if you get the paperwork and the documentation 98% right, that 2% that you get wrong will kill you, and that will trigger a buyback. And today, what's happening is buybacks are being triggered not by really material errors, but sort of the I got you type of errors. And until we change that climate in Washington with the regulators, you're not going to see lending to the point you should. And that's the comments made over the last month by Jamie Dimon at Chase and also John Stump at Wells sort of point that out, where they publicly are questioning, why would we lend at the bottom of the market if in fact we're going to get so penalized by doing so. And, you know, for them to come out and say it publicly is a strong statement.
Well, also, what are the ramifications? Because, I mean, let's say the sins of the industry were committed in 2003 to 2006 or 7, and the fines that have just been levied out, you know, we pick up a newspaper every month, there's another $10 billion fine paid by a major lender. How does that help the mood of aggressiveness? In other words, to me, that would be pretty discouraging going, okay, well, we're not going to do anything wrong.
You're right. That's exactly right. And the fact of the matter is, what the Mortgage Bankers Association is doing is working with the legislators, working with the administration, and say, you know, let's the past is the past. I think we've paid for the mistakes. It's time to wipe the slate clean. And maybe the regulation has overreacted to what was the problem, and the pendulum has swung too far in the other direction, and that's hurting the market. There's clear data that says the housing recovery is slogging back and forth, and we believe it's because of the tight regulation. So let's take the regulation, and instead of swinging it, you know, to a very conservative place, let's get it back to the middle. Let's get that pendulum to the middle, where we have proven as an industry we do need to be regulated, but it does need to be smart regulation, so we can get back to responsible lending in building a solid real estate market.
Yeah, we need to get away from vindictive changes to constructive ones.
That's exactly correct.
A couple of things that just recently came out. Fannie Freddie, somebody that went through a bankruptcy or a foreclosure, had to wait for 7 years, and that's changed to a much lesser of a time frame. So seems to be a positive leaning in the right direction.
Yes, agreed. And that you know, the evidence and the starting evidence that pendulum may be, you know, that regulatory pendulum that we believe has swung too far in the conservative route may be coming back to the middle. That's a great example, Bruce, of that pendulum maybe coming back to middle.
One of the things, you know, it's interesting, you're in charge of a national organization, but you work in a location that's Ohio.
Right.
And so, you know, a lot of things, let's say in Ohio, prices aren't as volatile as in California where I am, that's for sure.
Right.
When FHA lowered the loan limits in my town from 500 grand to 350, they changed the dynamics of a lot of things, including what builders will even think about building.
Right.
So I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but I'm just saying those changes when you reverse those numbers from 500,000 to 350. And I guess my question is, my sense is that isn't the only reduction that might be in place. Is the mood in Washington to keep on reducing FHA's footprint in the marketplace?
You know, I would tell you that a year ago, the answer to that question would be yes. I think today, the policymakers and the regulators see that the housing recovery has stalled, and you know, that may have been a you know, almost a reaction to FHA when FHA needed the quote unquote bailout in the reserves, and the MMI fund went negative, and they're supposed to be up to 2%, and there was some policymakers in Washington that was beating the let's get the government out of the out of the lending business per se.
Right.
Let's take it private. And although in you know, let's the bottom line is the housing in America is too big to be completely private, and it hasn't been private since about 1935. So, you know, at the end of the day, it might sound great. It's a great soundbite, but it's not reality. So I think that was a knee-jerk reaction to what was going on with the MMI fund. But now, again, that the housing market has the recovery has kind of stalled, I think you see that the attitude's a little bit different. Just like with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, as they were talking about raising G fees again and all the above, and that talk has kind of stalled as well. Because I think, you know, lowering those loan amounts FHA is going to hurt the market, you know, out in the higher priced areas, East Coast, West Coast, so forth. And I think they see the same thing with the GSE. So actually, A year ago, I would have said, yeah, I think that's going to continue. But now, I think the regulators and the policymakers have paused because they do believe that that would probably stall the markets even further. So I think now it's a little bit different environment.
When we started 2014, was the mood toward the kind of year we were going to have in 2014 different than the reality that we've experienced?
Another great question. I think the answer is yes. And, you know, just like weathermen, economic forecasters, they hate when you remember their forecast. Right? they hate that part. And, what's happened is both at Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, MBA, the chief economists, all of them had the purchased business home sales up about 15% versus last year, versus 13. Well, what's happened year to date is not only are they not up, 15%, they're down about 10%. So actually, versus the forecast, the housing market has really not performed the way the experts expected it to. And I think that's a wake-up call to the policymakers, and it's also a wake-up call to the regulators in Washington. And I think that's some of the byproduct of what we're seeing.
What's interesting is, I definitely felt that 2014 would be a good year in California for both volume and price increases. And if you looked at the volume of sales in 2013, you had an expectation that the volume should go up. But the problem is, I think we looked at the chart of volume and didn't analyze what it was made up of. The buyer wasn't that first-time buyer person who was going to someday grow up and buy the next house and then build a home or something like that. It was, the volume was on the backs of hedge funds and foreign investors and cash buyers in quantities that we had never seen before.
That's a great point. And that happened more out in the coast. A lot of that was happening in Florida, a lot in the East Coast. But you're right. That was a buyer that's not your family. There's a difference, and that's a buyer the type of buyer we've never seen before, and really not the type of buyer that's going to sustain a housing market over time. That's a great point.
You said that 2014 stalled, and it has. What's been the reasoning that you've heard to explain it?
Well, I think the largest reason is access to credit.
Okay.
Is a big one. It's more difficult to get loans. I think the second one is obviously the job market. I think talking to loan officers, I often tell people, in 28 years, I've never seen anyone take mortgage application buying a home on part-time work. So at the end of the day, I think you need, it's full-time jobs, it's jobs. And then after that, it's jobs and it's access to credit. And I think the job market is still soft. And obviously with tight access to credit, you've got that problem. And I think for the first time, in my 28 years in the mortgage banking business / real estate business, for the first time, student debt, the debt young people are coming out of college with is preventing them from being a homeowner, in their, mid to late 20s and possibly early 30s. So I think jobs is number one. I think access to credit is number two. And just the exploding student debt is number three.
You know what's interesting about that student debt, and I definitely heard the same number, it's over a trillion, it's more than a credit card, and did a little research on that, and all those numbers are correct, but the makeup of the debt surprised me. So I would have thought, okay, under 30 age group has to have the lion's share of that debt. They have 33% of the debt. And then the person between 30 and 40 has another 30%, and the person over 40 has another 30%. And I think what's interesting about that is that you have people that are already mature in the workforce having to retool their skills and borrow money to get it reeducated.
Right.
So in a way, that's a healthy sign, but it does get in the way when your back-end ratios are so tight that if you have college debt and a monthly payment, that's hurting your qualification. It does have a ramification, no doubt.
It has a large one, and statistically, the MBA studies show that today a college graduate comes out with $35,000 of student debt, and that is a heavy burden. And, you know, over the last, this is my take on it, and I feel strongly about this, over the last two decades, you know, as inflation's going up 1 or 2%, most universities have been pinning their tuition cost up 8%, over 8% over a 20-year period.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, obviously, you know, higher education is extremely important to this country. Everyone, you know, most people need to have that college education. But the fact of the matter is, the universities have gotten away, you know, scot-free without being questioned. They get a free pass when it comes to politics. And, you know, today, you should not, the middle class of America should not have to go broke educating their children. And that's exactly what's happening today, and something's wrong with that.
Yeah, I think if you looked at that chart, you'd see a very similar chart to next to healthcare costs.
That's right. That's right. And it's wrong. And no one, you know, at this point politically, they've gotten a free pass. And I think there's in mid-America, there's a lot of anger that's been built up to the cost of higher education. And politically, they've gotten a free pass, and that's got to end.
You know, in the research that I've done, I've actually looked at newspaper advertising in the 1935 era, before the government. And you certainly could get real estate loans. You just had to have 50% down. And the problem with that is that you wouldn't have a housing market, and you wouldn't consider, you know, owner-occupant very important. And I hope, as a country, we don't get away from that. The GSE reform, and we'll be able to talk a little bit about that on the panel. It looks to me like they're having pretty profitable years now, and that would come under that category of, really, do we want to get rid of this? And that would seem a little vindictive than constructive at this point.
Yeah, I think so. There's no doubt that there needs to be reform. Where we're at today with the GSEs cannot be maintained. I do believe the GSEs or the type of structure the GSEs are, that there's a government guarantee, a very well protected government guarantee needs to be in place for there to be enough liquidity in the housing market moving forward. There does need to be reform, but at the end of the day too, we do need a government guarantee as well, so there's enough liquidity, and we know that investors around the world would purchase those bonds and so forth. As we know, that underneath lying loans are high quality. That's the key, and that's where the industry's at today. So there's no doubt that GSE reform needs to happen. But the entities as they are today are doing just fine.
Bill, we've run out of time. Thank you so much for joining us, and we look forward to you being on our panel in October.
You're welcome, Bruce, and I really appreciate the invite, and I am looking forward to spending the evening with you here in a few weeks.
All right. Bill, thanks a lot.
The Norris Group would like to thank its gold sponsors for supporting I Survived Real Estate, Adrenaline Athletics, Coldwell Banker Town & Country, Elite Auctions, In a Day Development, Inland Valley Association of Realtors, Investor Experts, Jennifer Buys Houses, Keystone CPA, Las Brisas Escrow, LA South REIA, Lavis Associates, Pilot Limousine, Primary Residential Mortgage, Northern California Real Estate Investors Association, North San Diego Real Estate Investors, Real Wealth Network, Realty 411 Magazine, Rick and Leanne Rossiter, Personal Real Estate Magazine, Sonica Corporation, South Point Companies, Spinnaker Loans, Tony Alvarez, UDirect IRA Services, and the Council of Multiple Listing Services. See isurvivedrealestate.com for video of the live event and more on our sponsors.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.